A national award-winning program that's sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and this court. We invite high school students from all over the state to come join us for oral argument. They are given materials about the case they are about to hear and may have even had presentations in their classes about this case. And at noon or whenever we finish this morning, the students will meet with a justice to talk about the procedures used in the courthouse. And this afternoon at noon, the students will meet with me. Anyone else who would like to stay, you're all cordially invited. Well, we've met you. Now let us introduce the court to you. Starting on my far right is an empty seat that's usually occupied by Justice David Prosser. He will not be participating in these cases. As next to the empty seat is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To my immediate right is Justice William Babich. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice John Wilcox, and to his left, Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far left, Justice Diane Sykes. With those introductions made, I will call the first case, 98-2795, John Norquist et al. Versus Kate Zeiske. And Attorney Hurwitz, you're representing John Norquist et al.
Yes, Your Honor. I represent the plaintiffs in this case, including, and the et al. Includes most particularly Mr. and Mrs. Boney and Ms. Brand. They own agricultural land in the town of Lodi. They were not parties to the original action, which this court dealt with 5 years ago. The critical and, I believe, decisive fact in this case is that in 1998, the agricultural land of the Bonies and Bran was assessed per acre at over three times the agricultural land of three of their immediately adjacent neighbors and a fourth nearby neighbor, all comparable properties. The figures appear at page 29 of our principal brief, but for example, Mr. and Mrs. Boney were assessed at $1,600 per acre. The Hamilton property was assessed at $476 per acre. This information is the dollar information that was not available in the original action when you heard it. Today, we are dealing with the two requirements that you set in the original action, which everybody is referring to as the Norquist case. You set two requirements for proving the statute unconstitutional. And for each requirement, there are three kinds of questions. Number one, exactly what were we required to do? Number two, did we do it? And number three, what standard of review applies when you decide whether we did it?
Counsel, before you get into that, could you address, at least for a few moments, the mootness issue raised by the defendants?
Yes. If this afternoon you will hear a challenge to the Secretary of Revenue's rule accelerating use value assessment so it is fully effective January 1, 2000, even though the statute contemplated that it be effective fully only in 2007. If you nevertheless decide that the Secretary had authority to do that, despite the words of the statute, this case is moot because we are seeking only prospective relief. We are asking that you declare the statute unconstitutional, effective with the next assessment date, January 1, 2003. We have no interest in disrupting the Wisconsin assessment system. Our interest is in protecting the integrity of the uniformity clause of the Wisconsin Constitution.
So, Mr. Horowitz,
Justice Babich, are you finishing?
Oh, just a quick follow-up.
Sure.
If I may. So you are saying that if in the Mallow case we determined that the Wisconsin Administrative Code in the issue in that case is appropriate and is valid, you're saying we can shut the books on this case?
Yes.
Mr. Horowitz, and my question is, you're talking about this statute being unconstitutional, and I can't clearly understand from the briefs is your attack that it's unconstitutional on its face, or is your attack that it's unconstitutional as applied to your clients?
Both. Now, in the first element in the Norquist test applied to this case means that the Bonies and the Brands had to prove that their agricultural land is overassessed and other agricultural land is underassessed as a result of the statute. And the case talks about overassessed and underassessed. Well, compared to what? The answer is compared to each other. That's what non-uniformity is about, comparing properties with each other. Otherwise, as long as everyone in a municipality was assessed below fair market value, no one could invoke the uniformity clause to challenge non-uniformity, not even this court.
Well, what if you had taken the properties in question, the two properties in question, and that you claim were overassessed, and then compared them to four properties located up in northern Wisconsin? Would that still have been a valid comparison?
Only if those four properties were comparable. However, it would be unlikely that properties so far away would be deemed comparable properties. Here we have the three of the four comparables are next door, and the fourth is nearby.
So you read the word comparable, while I'm looking, I don't remember if, is the word comparable in our Norquist 1 opinion?
No.
Comparable properties?
It is. I don't think it is, but I think it's implicit in the Norquist opinion that uniformity involves a comparison of comparable properties, because if the properties are not comparable, there's no basis for proving non-uniformity. But the idea that uniformity is to be comparative is something that is set forth in the Levine case, which we believe settled the matter, and in the Fort Howard case, where this court initially said that the petitioner must prove that it was overvalued and others were undervalued, but then in that case went on to describe the petitioner's burden as being to show that its improvements were unconstitutionally overvalued as compared to other manufacturers.
Counsel, I want to focus in on that. First of all, do you agree that the Norquist 1 case only cited Fort Howard for the discussion of this over and unders? Was that correct?
Yes.
And so at least arguably we can look to the Fort Howard case for the underlying rationale of our more recent opinion in this case, the Norquist case. Fort Howard has the test as requiring showing of overvalued and undervalued, but your argument is other than that, it seems.
Yes, well, it depends on which page of Fort Howard you look at. At page 508, it says that. At the next page, it talks about unconstitutionally overvalued as compared to other manufacturers. Now, is the test comparison or not?
And what does the next sentence say after that?
The one I'm thinking of is its improvements were unconstitutionally overvalued as compared to other manufacturers.
That's right. And I'm talking about the sentence right after that.
Well,
if the petitioner's 1975 valuation was correct, as was concluded here, and the petitioner must show that the other Lake District manufacturers were undervalued in 1975, I mean, it seems to me that very next sentence then again
that's exactly
goes back to this over and under. So I agree with you that it's not a
well,
perhaps
goes back,
a model of clarity there.
The very next sentence is exactly the situation in the Levine case, where in the Levine case, the property owners who owned newer homes were assessed at fair market value. The other property owners who owned older homes were assessed below fair market value, and that was enough for this court to decide that there was an unconstitutional non-uniformity.
Let me tell you my problem and see if you can help me. As I look at the Levine case and the language in that case, you're absolutely right with what the language says. That's my view of it. That is, it's relative to the other properties. But then I, and I'm looking at page 371. Under this principle, known as the rule of uniformity, taxpayers may demonstrate that although their properties were assessed at fair market value, other comparable properties were assessed significantly below fair market value. In other words, the essence of that is one compared relative to the other.
That's exactly.
Yeah, that's the language in Levine. Then we get to the language in Fort Howard. And just the very language that we were discussing, those two areas, one says, in my mind, rather clearly, it is over and under some norm. And that's the interpretation that the Court of Appeals took in this case. It's over something and under something. The other paragraph that we've discussed thus far in the Fort Howard case, in my opinion, kind of muddies the water. It combines both of them. But we get to Norquist, and it seems to me that the opinion in this case, relying on Fort Howard, and help me, I need help on this, relying on Fort Howard then, the Court of Appeals interprets it as this over and under and not this relative to one another.
There are two answers to that. First of all, as I've said, this would mean that the uniformity clause would be a nullity in any municipality where everyone is underassessed. So it doesn't make any sense to read the uniformity clause that way. Second, here we're talking about agricultural land, which is not being valued by fair market value at all. It's being valued by a complex formula. So a comparison to fair market value makes even less sense where we're not talking about fair market value as the standard of value. So in 1998, we can look and see that the Bonies and the Brands were assessed per acre at three times their neighbors without any reference to fair market value because they weren't assessed on fair market value in 1998. They were assessed at a combination of a frozen value and an agricultural use value according to the formula in the statute. So even if you were to conclude that over-assessment and under-assessment were separate tests, notwithstanding the Levine case, that they were separate tests, and somehow this court in Norquist 1 had in effect overruled Levine without mentioning it. It doesn't matter here because we're not talking about fair market value. We're talking about comparative overassessment under a formula which is not based just on fair market value. So that's the second answer to your question.
Court of Appeals counsel attributed the different standards to the difference between a facial challenge to the statute and an as-applied challenge. Do you have a response to that?
Yes.
Going back to the issue of which standard is correct.
I don't see any difference at all. And the Court of Appeals never explained what the difference was. We're challenging the statute as it applies to the Bonies and Brand and on its face. Indeed, that's what you asked us to do in the Norquist case, because the initial burden was to show that a plaintiff who owned agricultural land was overassessed and underassessed, whatever that means. And the second element related to the statute and not to the particular facts of the particular, not necessarily to the particular facts of the particular plaintiff. So it doesn't make any difference whether, because we're challenging it both ways.
Well, I understand that you're challenging it both ways, but you don't think that a lawsuit or a claim that wants or seeks a reassessment on one piece of property for 1 year is different from a claim that wants to throw out a whole statute around the
Yes, I do. To the extent that we are seeking to challenge the statute completely. Now, that's the second element of the Norquist test. But the Court of Appeals was talking not about the constitutional element, the second element of the Norquist test, but the first element, which this Court described as an initial burden. And that initial burden was necessarily one that was as applied to here, the Bonies and Brand. So you might put it this way, that with respect to the initial element, we are challenging the statute as it applies to the Bonies and Brand, and With respect to the second element, we're challenging it both ways. But we're challenging it certainly on its face to the extent that we're asking that you invalidate the statute in its entirety, not just as to the Bonies and Brand.
I read the Court of Appeals opinion as indicating that this challenge, or their understanding of this challenge, was a claim that the statute is unconstitutional on its face. Did you read the Court of Appeals opinion that way?
I think that's what the Court of Appeals thought.
Well,
as I've just explained, I think it's a combination of the two.
Well, why, if the Court of Appeals has as its premise that this is as distinguished from Levine, and that's what the Court of Appeals did in this case, distinguished Levine and said, Levine, that's an as-applied case. Here the challenge is it's unconstitutional on its face. That's what the Court of Appeals said. What, if that is in error, how, if at all, is the analysis compromised by that threshold error?
Well, it's compromised by the threshold error because the Court of Appeals comes to the wrong conclusion about whether we satisfy the initial burden. The facts, as found by the trial court, were that we satisfied the initial burden. And that is something that is to be reviewed by standard of review of clearly erroneous. That's an evidentiary or historical fact, whether we satisfy the initial burden. If it were a constitutional fact, then we would have had to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. But if there's one thing that is clear in the language in Norquist, the court carefully said that the initial burden had to be proven, and the second element then had to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. So the second element is the constitutional test. The initial burden is in the nature of showing facts which establish that we have plaintiffs who are actually injured by the statute.
So, with all respect to the Court of Appeals, I didn't quite understand what burden they were holding you to with respect to this first requirement. What do you think, where were they in error? Where was the Court of Appeals in error? What was the burden they were holding you to that they said you didn't meet?
I think they were saying, in effect, that we had to prove that the Bonies and Brand, or one of them, were assessed at more than fair market value. And that is the mistake that the basic mistake that the Court of Appeals made. Now, they also said that we didn't prove that they were over-assessed, even relatively, as a result of the statute. However, the undisputed testimony in this case is not only the figures that I have mentioned to you at the beginning of the case, which comes straight from calculations from the 1998 assessment roll, but the undisputed testimony of the assessor, that he would have tried to bring these properties into uniformity, but the statute prevented him from doing that. Mr. Marslender was not even cross-examined on that issue. So those facts, the calculations based directly on the assessment roll, which is in evidence as Exhibit 102, and the agricultural line of that is, you know, line 4. It's a little unclear on some of the pages, but if you look to page 11, you'll see the code. Those facts are undisputed. So we proved that we satisfied the first test.
You think that the test established in Norquist, simply that your burden is to simply show that your client's property was overassessed with respect to comparable properties.
Yes, and if it were otherwise,
as a result of this statute.
Yes,
as a result. Yeah.
And if it were otherwise, it would seriously erode the uniformity clause in a way that's never happened before. Perhaps the Fort Howard case might be described as being ambiguous. The Levine case is not ambiguous.
What does the word overassessed mean to you within the context of this?
It means to me comparatively overassessed compared to other comparable properties.
That's what the trial court found also.
Yes. It doesn't mean overassessed compared to fair market value, because if it did, then the Levine case would have to be overruled. Now, I want to talk about...
How do you know if the properties are comparable?
Because there was evidence that the properties were comparable.
Aside from their fair market value.
because there was testimony that the properties were comparable from our expert, Mary Reavy, and from the assessor who testified that they were similar in size and location and so forth.
And so the resulting difference in the assessment comes out because of the formula used in the statute.
Exactly. And solely because of that.
Now, the second element, the constitutional element, is to demonstrate beyond a reasonable doubt that the statute does not create uniform taxation to the extent practicable. I believe that that has two components. First, that it doesn't create uniform taxation, and then the element of to the extent practicable. Now, does it create non-uniform taxation? Well, one thing that this court said in the Norquist case is that it is certain that during the freeze, and referring to another owner of agricultural land, the value of Jorgensen's property will change by an amount different from other agricultural land. So he will not benefit from the same amount as other owners of agricultural land. So this court in Norquist has pretty much said, or clearly implied, that the statute does create non-uniformity. The real question that's left is, was it practical to eliminate that non-uniformity? Put it another way, what does the to the extent practicable mean? In this context, it means, was it practical to eliminate the non-uniformity that was created by the statute? And here it clearly was, because it was admitted that by the department's expert, Mr. Rosner, that you could assess agricultural land without a freeze. It was undisputed, and it's obvious as a matter of logic that you can create a statute that taxes agricultural land without a freeze. You can even create a formula that's based transitionally, that's based partially on fair market value and partially on use value. So, there's no requirement in Norquist or in any other case that we have quantitative proof statewide of the dollar amounts of the non-uniformity. In Gottlieb, in fact, although it only involved Milwaukee, this court didn't hesitate to strike down the statute with no quantitative proof at all. Here we've proven, as part of our initial burden, that the Bonies and the Brands were relatively overassessed, and that's enough. The court has found that it's certain that the statute creates non-uniformity, and it is both proven and self-evident that that it was practical to eliminate that non-uniformity.
Can I ask this question, counsel? If the constitutional test focuses on the extent to which the statute creates non-uniformity or inequity, isn't it more correct to say in this case that the inequities, to the extent that they exist during the phasing period, were created by pre-existing methods of assessment that existed at the municipal level, and all the statute does is lock those in? It doesn't create the inequities, they pre-existed.
Well, it creates non-uniformity in the sense that it prevents the assessor from assessing properties uniformly. Now, if the non-uniformity existed in the past and the statute locks it in, then it creates non-uniformity. It's a semantic point, whether the statute created it or whether the statute continued it. I think when we're talking about whether non-uniformity is created by the statute, it's better to say whether the statute requires that the non-uniformity exists, because that's what it does. And where it got its origin doesn't matter. It's still created by the statute because in 1998, this assessor could not assess farmland non-uniformly. And in 1998, and throughout the freeze, nobody could assess farmland uniformly because the statute mandated a formula which this court has already decided is certain to create non-uniformity. And so for that reason, it doesn't matter whether the freeze, whether the 1995 assessments were uniform or not uniform. The point is that no one can correct them later. We're stuck with whatever we had in 1995. And that is
why the statute creates non-uniformity.
So it creates non-uniformity by preventing correction of previous non-uniformities that exist for other reasons.
Well, it creates non-uniformity in two ways, by preventing correction of prior non-uniformity, but it also creates non-uniformity because it is certain that agricultural values change. So even if the 1995 assessments were frozen at exactly fair market value, it is certain that values will change during the phase-in period, and it is certain that non-uniformity will be created, and it is certain that there's no power in the assessor to correct that resulting non-uniformity, even if there was non-uniformity in 1995. So the statute doesn't merely carry over pre-existing non-uniformity, it also creates new non-uniformity where none existed before.
Well, if that is a correct interpretation, then a factual basis is not even needed because theoretically you're right.
Yes, but we did provide evidence too, just in case.
Yes, I ran into
those. We appreciate that, counsel. All right. Thank you, Mr. Horowitz. I show Peter Anderson of the Department of Administration representing the Department of Revenue 15 minutes. H.D. Peterson of the Stroud Firm representing the Farm Rural Bureau at 15 minutes, and then Robert Hurwitz at 5 minutes. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. May it please the Court. I am Peter Anderson from the Division of Administration, but formerly of the Department of Justice. And having tried this case and argued in the Court of Appeals, I was asked to argue here. I'm actually with the Division of Hearings and Appeals, so it's an attached agency. Mr. Horowitz concluded by saying, well, they presented evidence just in case. But since this court had said you need to provide evidence, I think that was somewhat required of him. But what's particularly interesting is what the scant amount of evidence they ever came up with. And that's why 5 years ago, Mr. Horowitz was before this court arguing, you don't need to know anything more about the statute other than that farmland does change in value over time. And this locks that in, and therefore it's unconstitutional. And this court said, no, we actually want to know how does it actually affect those assessments. We went back down. We had a trial. We had multiple depositions. We had a couple of two-inch-high expert reports by Mr. Horowitz's experts that never saw the light of day at trial because they were flawed. And we come back today, 5 years later, and we hear the same argument that was argued 5 years ago, that all we have to do is think about it. When I think about it, having tried the case and having looked at this issue very closely at periods in my life, it occurs to me that maybe it's not so surprising that plaintiffs failed in proving this case. Because their theory was farmland's going to change in value vis-a-vis each other, and therefore it's going to be locked in at the assessed value during this period that its values are being changed, that its values are changing. If we sit back and we think, now why would farmland, we know farmland's going to change in value, but why would farmland in the same taxing jurisdiction, one part go way up and one part go way down during a 10-year period? Why would that happen? When we look at what happened in Lodi, that's not what we saw. We didn't see land, the Boney's land value going down and being stuck at the high assessment level, or these allegedly comparable properties values going up and being stuck at the low level. The value of that land didn't change between 1994 and 1996, or there's certainly no plausible story as to why it changed. What happened is there was an assessor in Lodi who was did his own thing, and it wasn't what the law required, and he ended up deliberately underassessing certain farmland. That then gets locked in. What would he do in 1998 if we took the handcuffs off this guy? According to Mr. Horowitz, he would achieve uniformity. I don't know why he didn't achieve uniformity when the handcuffs weren't on in the first place.
Let's suppose you have a different assessor who comes in, looks at this, and says, "Look."
Okay, if that were the case, Your Honor, then that would be a possibility. That'd be
now
a hypothetical.
Now they can't do that, right? Because it's frozen.
That's right. And if we had any evidence of that, we could examine what was its real impact in any real sense, and is it worth throwing out a statute that is going to get us to a system of use valuation of farmland in the next few years, if not today, Is it worth it throwing out that statute to correct that hypothetical possibility where there's no proof that it's ever happened in this state?
What, in your judgment, did they have to prove?
They had to prove, one, the threshold showing that their property was overassessed and other properties underassessed.
Compared
to its value. And that's the normal meaning of overassessed and underassessed. And certainly when this court used those terms, overassessed and underassessed, I can't believe that those words were going to be redundant, which is what Mr. Horowitz is reading at the moment. So overassessed is the same as underassessed.
When you say compared to its value, do you mean compared to its fair market value?
Is compared to either its fair market value or its use value. I mean, either one is constitutionally permitted. It's just you would want to compare them comparably. You wouldn't want to compare its value to its fair market value for one and its value to use value for the other. That's certainly open since the Constitution permits use valuation, and Mr. Horowitz isn't challenging the end result of the statute.
Well, what's wrong with Mr. Horowitz's posit here that the overassessed as means overassessed as compared to other comparable properties?
Well,
why is he wrong?
I think it misreads the language of this court's decision and the Four Tower decision that upon which it's based. There's a value of property that is. Those are the precedents of this court that when a taxpayer complains that their property is misvalued or that other property is undervalued, there needs to be a determination of its impact on this taxpayer's fair taxation, which in a few cases, such as Levine, such as Gottlieb, can be known without the actual empirical evidence. In Levine, for example, the method of taxation was held to be arbitrary and improper, and it was arbitrary and improper. For older properties, the tax assessor would not consider the sales price, would not use the sales price. This case...
Do you think that both the Levine case and your Lodi case are just extraordinary, and that maybe in no other situation in this state do you have this situation?
I'm sorry?
Well, I'm saying, are these so extraordinary that there have been bad assessments not following the statute? Or do you think they run throughout the state?
There will be cases where there's bad assessments.
And this statute locks them in, right?
But those bad assessments exist under the market valuation system.
That's right. But this statute locks it in.
If they occur, it would lock them in.
Locks it in.
For a while. Yes, Ms.
So what you're saying is that the assessment of these other four properties up in Lodi is totally irrelevant. The only relevant proof would have been what the Bones and Brown's property was assessed at and what their fair market value was.
No, you're right. The other properties. Oh, but when you ask comparable properties, I wasn't hearing it right. No, he needs to show that his property is overassessed and that other property is underassessed. It has to be, I don't know that it has to be strictly comparable in the sense of comparable sales for doing assessment practice, but they need to be subject to the same tax jurisdiction.
Overassessed as to fair market value, underassessed as to fair market value.
Or alternatively, use value. But as to value, use value.
So he had one more step to do and he failed.
Well, that was one step they failed to do. They also failed to show that it was the result of the freeze that these values. You know, if you look at...
I'm having a difficult trouble with the first step.
No, I think there's trouble with the first step. There's trouble with the second step, and that's as to the first test. When you get to the second test, there's a complete failure.
Let's just go back. As I hear it, and I could be hearing it wrong, you say it's overassessed or underassessed as fair market value. Mr. Horowitz says it's underassessed or overassessed in relation to each other that are comparable. Now, fair market value is usually the sale price of reasonable buyer and seller. If the properties are comparable, that's why I asked him, what does he mean by comparable? I assume size, location, blah, blah, blah. They'll sell for the same. So why, I don't hear a difference between your fair market value and comparable. What am I missing?
Pardon me?
What am I missing?
I'm not sure I know what you're missing, Your Honor. A property is comparable in the sense that we can look to that property and say its value is an indication of the value of this other property. If you got a four-bedroom house here, right, it'll indicate the value of a four-bedroom house
and
here. You don't need that when you're comparing agricultural land, because, and I don't think Mr. Horowitz needed to go that far in this case. He didn't need to say, here's 40 acres and here's 40 acres. I think it's okay to say, here's 120 acres and here's 40 acres. So it may not be comparable.
Right, so it's
but they would need to be comparable. I think the comparisons that are made, the relative comparisons, the assertion that there is this relative under-assessment or over-assessment may require comparability. But you could have grade 2 tillable land and grade 1 tillable land, and they have somewhat different values. But you could still make, conclusions. You could still make conclusions about is it over-assessed or under-assessed relative to its value. Each property has its own value. You say, here's the value of this property, it's $10,000. Here's its assessment, it's $15,000. Here's the value of this property, it's $5,000. Here's its assessment, it's $7,000. The properties aren't comparable, but the assessment ratios.
But the chief's question goes right to the heart of the problem that I'm having with you, which you said it's far better than I. That we know what the fair market value was at least a year or two before of these two properties, right? Because they were essentially bought a year or two before. And no one's questioning that this $1,900 an acre was essentially the fair market value.
No, I would say that seems right.
Wait, pardon?
That seems right. The sales price is the best indicator of value.
Okay, so if you don't challenge the comparability, if you say that they are comparable properties between these two properties and the four, then haven't they established ipso facto that yours are under-assessed and theirs are over-assessed?
If you look at the 98 assessments for these properties that they're saying are under-assessed, those assessments are virtually identical to the sales price. Under the system they're challenging, with the assessor's hands tied, those assessments are virtually identical to the sales price. And so in that sense, there is no proof of under-assessment. The reason for that, Justice Babbage, is that this assessor was as much a rogue assessor in 98 as he was in 94. He went and he said, you know, I can't value the farmland what I'd like to, because now there are small farmettes and I'd like to be able to stick them with the high value. But I think I'll value the property. You know, the structure is high. And that's exactly what happened in that case. Had you taken the valuation he gave to the structures and then applied to the remaining agricultural land an imputed sales price, the assessment of those lands would have been roughly 150% of the sales price. So in this case, because we have this rogue assessor, both before and during the freeze, there's actually no impact of this law on uniformity, except possibly to improve it over what it would have been.
Okay.
That's just an idiosyncrasy of this evidence, because that's who they chose to look at.
I don't want to interrupt.
Yes.
Thank you very much. If I may, I'd like to go back to your discussion of what the law is. You seem to suggest we can get rid of Levine as some kind of aberration.
No, Your Honor. I think Levine remains correct law.
Levine says, in defining uniformity, it says, under this principle known as the rule of uniformity, so it's saying this is how we interpret the Constitution and that provision, taxpayers may demonstrate that although their properties were assessed at fair market value, not over-assessed, at fair market value, and other comparables were assessed significantly below, that is, relative to the fair market value, that's the test. That's what Levine says is the test. So it isn't just the result, but that we can, maybe it's an anomaly and maybe there were problems. But this court, or rather the court in Levine, it was this court in Levine, said that is how we interpret the Wisconsin Constitution Uniformity Clause.
But if you read the very opening language of Levine, it says, we are asked in this case to decide, does Walther apply where the assessment practices are arbitrary and improper? And it's in that context that this court said, yes, that's the proof you can adduce. And that makes sense, because where the assessment practices can be readily determined to be arbitrary and improper, we don't need to go beyond that to say, well, how does it actually affect anybody?
Right. The case can be distinguished on its facts, and maybe the court did not have to say, hey, we're going to interpret what the uniformity clause means in the Constitution, but it did, and it said it relative to one another.
I think when I read judicial decisions that they normally should be interpreted as narrowly as reasonable, not as broadly that's reasonable. And in this, in that case in particular, where the very opening statement of the issue is, what do we do in the case of a taxpayer who is not claiming his land is overassessed, but is claiming that there's a systematic underassessment of other land because of arbitrary, proven arbitrary and improper assessment practices? Do we, are we going to impose the Walter requirement, or are we going to even impose the requirement of under and overassessment?
Did Northwest One sub silentio overrule that interpretation of the uniformity clause set forth in Levine?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think Levine remains the law for the situation that it, it addresses. Norquist, in contrast, the rule of uniformity under the Constitution is, under the Constitution says that the rule of taxation shall be uniform. On its face, this state, this statute is completely uniform. It doesn't say this favored agricultural property will be taxed this way and this disfavored property will be taxed this way. It says all property that's agricultural will be taxed using this freeze and phase in mechanism until we get to full use valuation. That's not the system. The situation that was presented in Levine or in Gottlieb, where we have these deliberate and obvious inequalities on the face of the practices or the statute. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Anderson, Mr. Peterson, representing the intervening defendant respondents.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Dale Peterson. I represent the Wisconsin Farm Bureau Federation, the National Educational and Cooperative Union of America, the National Farmers Organization, the Wisconsin Agribusiness Council, the Wisconsin Agri-Service Association, the Wisconsin Cattlemen's Association, the Wisconsin Corn Growers Association, the Wisconsin Federation of Cooperatives, the Wisconsin Pork Producers Association, the Wisconsin Potato and Vegetable Growers Association, the Wisconsin Soybean Association, the Wisconsin State Cranberry Growers Association, and Howard Paulson, a grain farmer in Jefferson County.
I'm glad you don't represent more, otherwise your 15 minutes would be up.
We limited our representation at 20.
But
we were collectively amicus in the original action and were the intervening defendants in this present action. When this case came before the court 5 years ago, the court did note that it was inevitable during the transitional period of the statute that some parcels of agricultural land would change in value at rates different than agricultural, other parcels of agricultural property. Despite that observation, the court dismissed the challenge to the statute. The petitioners argued that it was inevitable that there would be a lack of constitutionality with that dynamic. This court affirmed that this statute was entitled to the highest presumption of constitutionality, that it would only be overturned upon proof beyond a reasonable doubt that the statute failed to tax agricultural land uniformly to the extent practicable. And the court emphasized that practicable uniformity rather than absolute uniformity was the rule of law when this case was looked at the trial court. Faced with the law's highest burden of proof, all of the evidence that petitioners were able to get in the record at the trial related to the 1995 assessments that were set under the old market-based system. The brief that discussed the Lodi study of frozen 1995 assessments versus imputed value. Annexation study that related to parcels annexed into the city before and after 1995 and their frozen assessments, as well as Ms. Penman's table related to the assessment ratios in the 1800 Wisconsin municipalities in 1995. That evidence ended up being an indictment against the uniformity under the old market-based system. As one of the justices pointed out, the statute does not create the lack of uniformity that was looked at in this case. The effect of the statute is to perpetuate, maintain the status quo of the assessments that existed in 1995. Mr. Horowitz argued that in 1998, two properties, were overassessed in the town of Lodi at a rate three times higher than four other parcels of property. Those other four parcels of property constituted 122 acres of agricultural land. Those assessments on the other four properties that were underassessed were all set in a 1994 assessment that occurred 2 years before the effective date of the statute. The Bones bought their property in 1994. When this assessment scheme was in place, the Brands bought their property in 1995 when this assessment scheme was in place. They did not go to the Board of Review. They did not challenge this two-tiered assessment system that was in the town of Lodi when they had an opportunity. Any imperfection that exists related to the 122 acres is the result of their failure to go before the Board of Review when they had an opportunity in 1994 and 1995.
Counsel, let's see if I can summarize your position. Your position is all inequities, all non-uniformities are grandfathered in.
All assessments that existed in 1995 were frozen and were perpetuated under the statute.
But that's what I said.
And every owner of agricultural land had an opportunity and before they were frozen to perfect the quality and the uniformity of them, exercising their administrative remedies by going before the Board of the Review.
So now they've waived that. They've waived their constitutional rights.
Like in any other tax challenge, if you fail to exhaust your administrative remedies, you are unable to get a reassessment. Here they wouldn't even be entitled to a reassessment, and they would ask this court to strike down this case, this law, and to find it unconstitutional.
Well, if you don't fight an assessment in year one, can't you fight it in year two? Because every year you get a new assessment.
Well, both these parties had an opportunity to fight it at least once, and they failed to do it. As an afterthought, they asked the court to strike down the constitutionality of the law because they claim that there was an underassessment, not an overassessment of their property, but an underassessment of 122 acres in the town of Lodi. In this trial, there was evidence that out of 8.5 million acres of agricultural land in Wisconsin, 0 acres are overassessed. The record of this case is that out of 8.5 million acres of farmland in Wisconsin, 122.7 acres are underassessed. And the record also shows, without doubt, that the 122 acres of agricultural land in the town of Lodi were underassessed because of the aberrant assessment practices of the Lodi assessor. He set these assessments in 1994, 2 years before the statute went into effect. He had a two-tier system. If someone owned a large farm, which he characterizes 60 acres or more, they got a tax break. Their farmland was taxed at $500 or $600 per acre. If someone bought a small parcel of property, he taxed that at $1,600 to $1,700 per acre. That was never challenged before the Board of Review. And that is the extent of the lack of uniformity that's facing the court where you're asked to strike down this statute.
Counsel, could you respond to your opposing counsel's assertion that it has to be compared relative to the other owners? And he says, as long as all are below, no one could invoke the uniformity clause. Could you respond to that, please?
For the standard for reviewing and striking down this case, the overassessment and the underassessment elements, and there's been most of the discussion this morning on that element, this case is very different from Levine. There, Levine's were not trying to strike down the constitutionality of the Act by showing that the statute was applied to them unfairly.
Counsel, just because you have limited time, let me focus my question.
Yes.
And I hear his argument being this would be just an intolerable result. The legislature could not have
meant this to occur, that as long, to interpret it in the way you're advancing, that as long as you would interpret it that way, all those who were below, if they were all below, you could never invoke the uniformity clause.
Well, if they were all below at the same level, there would be uniformity. If they're all below at different levels, then there's a lack of uniformity. The remedy would be for a reassessment to bring them into uniformity, not to strike down the statute that was misapplied to create the non-uniformity.
I'm going to ask you this. What proof would satisfy the test that was set forth in Norquist? What proof would have had to be brought in?
The primary proof, the most important proof, would be that the level of assessment, the level of uniformity under the new use value system is inferior to the old market-based system, that there was a deterioration in the quality of uniformity, that whether there's absolute uniformity or practical uniformity, if there's a difference, it's measurable to quantify it. There's no proof here whatsoever that the quality of uniformity under the use value system is any less than under the old market-based system.
Well, let me just say that perhaps that test has been met here, because under the old system of fair market value, you had a chance of a new assessor coming in and not being a rogue assessor, and the opportunity to change assessments. Whereas under this statute, it's frozen. So doesn't that satisfy your test?
Well, the reality is that a temporary freeze does maintain the status quo. To the extent there's inequality, it is perpetuated. But everybody had an opportunity to exercise an administrative remedy to make sure that those inequities did not exist.
Prior
this court,
freeze.
In your test, said that the overassessment and the underassessment had to be a result of the statute. The proof here was the underassessment was not a result of the statute.
Your argument is premised on you have an opportunity beforehand to challenge this. What if you bought the property in 1995? Your new property owner, you wouldn't have had the opportunity before to challenge this.
If you bought property that had an established assessment, you would not be able to challenge it. But any amount of inequity that is perpetuated, again, is ameliorated by the phase-in mechanism itself. That's proven in this case. The 1998 assessment started to ameliorate the lack of uniformity that existed under the old system. The brand and the bones assessments dropped with use value. The assessments on their neighbor's agricultural land largely increased, so that the differential narrowed by the statute. The criticism of the statute is not that it causes any lack of uniformity, but that it fails to correct immediately all of the errors and the lack of uniformity under the old system. And this court should not strike down the statute on that basis.
Do these inequities ever get changed in this system?
There's a statute that provides for the correction of errors. So to the extent there's a correction of error, that would be applicable. But again, I think
Does that allow for correction of the frozen assessment?
Probably not. The frozen assessment only continued for 2 years. After 2 years, during the phase-in, it was being replaced by the use-value formula.
Which is premised on the frozen assessment, right?
That's right. It was being implemented at 10% annual increments.
So it's all pegged to that 95 assessment.
That's correct.
So the error gets perpetuated.
The error that existed under the old system, the error that was not corrected under the old system, would be perpetuated under the current system. And again, the standard is not absolute uniformity, but it is practicable uniformity. And this was a very reasoned and a very appropriate approach for the implementation of use value. In 1995, when it was implemented, Wisconsin farmers paid the third highest property taxes in the nation. Their rates of taxes were 2.5 to 5 times higher than the other farmers in the Midwest. the legislature, exercising its appropriate powers, saw that it was appropriate to give immediate tax relief to Wisconsin farmers and to phase in the use value. The transitional period initially was necessary so that the Farmland Agricultural Council could develop a use value formula, which is a very complex formula based upon rates of capitalization, interest rates, and commodity prices. It was necessary for this system of assessment to be integrated into the system that had been the law for more than a century. It was necessary for municipalities to prepare for a shift in taxes from agricultural to non-agricultural properties. It was necessary for the state to adjust its shared revenue formula. This was a reasonable approach for moving from one constitutional form of taxation to another form of constitutional taxation.
I've waited, Mr. Peterson, until your red light is on because I have a basic educational question for me. Suppose I owned agricultural land in Dane County, really close to Madison or Middleton, and I put 10 cows on it. And I assume that land is very valuable for potential development purposes, right?
I'm assuming that.
Okay. And suppose I owned acreage farther from the cities, and at least not now potential development land, and that I had a substantial farm operation, large herd of cattle, cows, and a lot of cash crops, right?
Yes.
The land of that second parcel is much less value than the land of the first parcel. Which of these, under the formula, which of these operations, assume the same acreage, will be taxed more?
If they're comparable from a production standpoint, they'll be taxed the same on a per acre basis.
Well, production in the sense of income from the farm?
That's correct.
Well, my second one is going to have much more income than the 10 cows that I milk by hand.
It's taxed based upon a per acre basis.
Same acreage.
The taxes on the two properties on a per acre basis would be the same so long as the productivity from that land would be the same.
They're not the same productivity, if you mean income from that land.
Well, if they were comparable in size, and you could...
Comparable in size. The only difference is one is just of a very minor farming area. The other is a major farm. One's value is really in the land because of potential development. What's the tax going to be?
Well,
I mean, don't give me the exact amount. Which one's going to be higher under the formula? Or maybe you can't answer that.
If they have the same agricultural productivity value, they will be taxed the same.
Do they have the same agricultural productivity value?
Well, your hypothetical related to cattle is not a fair hypothetical.
Okay, soybeans. I don't care what we put.
That makes it a fair
hypothetical. I'm not even going to harvest it.
Right.
I'm going to let it rot on
your
field.
Your Madison property, 100 acres in corn, which has a higher market value than the farm further out in the country, 100 acres corn land. They'll both be taxed uniformly on the same basis based upon the amount of income that they could produce in productive agriculture. The use value statute is going to enable you as a farmer to continue to farm your land close to Madison so that you're not taxed off the land. It is effective in preventing urban sprawl, and it's effective in preventing you from forcing you to sell your land because you can't afford to pay your taxes.
And that's a legislative decision.
That's correct.
Council, in your response, 100 acres of corn each, one in land that could be developed very valuably,
right,
and the other in the hinterland, is that on the potential for income or the actual income? For instance, what if I had 100 acres of corn but never harvested it?
It's based upon the potential for income.
So that's why when you hear this example, for instance, of some companies that maybe own property that's very valuable and they plant some acres of corn, never with the intent of
harvesting it, they still are
considered to be an operating farm. The legislature anticipated that someone might try to take advantage of this by warehousing valuable land and paying lower taxes. In response to that, they enacted a provision in Chapter 74 that provides that if an owner of agricultural land sells that land after they've taken the advantage of use value taxation, they have to pay back the tax benefit that they realized while it was in productive agriculture. If a developer wants to continue to farm, actively farm, large amounts of property in Wisconsin, it serves the very purpose of what the legislature is trying to accomplish, and that is to continue our agricultural heritage in Wisconsin. Now, first of all, corporations can't own farmland in Wisconsin, so we have to eliminate that. But if a landowner wants to continue to farm a large tract of agricultural property, they get the advantage of use value taxation. And hopefully it will continue to perpetuate that land in agricultural use indefinitely, because that's what the legislature is trying to accomplish.
Thank you.
So if I'm a legitimate farmer, and I'm farming 100 acres just a couple miles west of Madison, which has got huge development potential, but I'm legitimately farming it. I got milkers, I got cows, well, you know, I'm legit. I will pay taxes based upon the agricultural value of that land, correct?
Based upon the productive value of that land.
Productive value.
The amount of income that can be generated from that land.
But then, if when I reach age 65 and I decide I want to move to better climates and I sell that and I realize from that sale the value of that land as developable land, I will get socked with some back taxes?
You will get socked with some back taxes. You'll be able to sell it based upon its fair market value, but by you taking advantage of use value assessment and paying a lower amount of taxes, you will pay higher taxes upon the sale.
Unless you engage in some nice estate planning and have a transfer that maybe isn't a sale.
No, as soon as the land is taken out of productive agriculture, it's what triggers the payment of the tax. So if you have sophisticated estate planning and the farm passes from one generation to the next and they continue to farm it, there is no tax burden that is imposed under that circumstance.
Suppose the farmer decides to develop himself.
As soon as the land is taken out of productive agriculture, as soon as he sells his lots, he's going to pay back the tax benefit that he's realized with the use value statute for a period of time retroactive.
So this bill, or this law, if it's labeled the developer's dream, that would be an unfair label to attach to it.
It would have to be a developer that wants to tie up all of his capital farming and to perpetually keep farming. Now, if the law accomplishes that, that means we will maintain our agricultural heritage in Wisconsin, which we're trying to do.
Thank you, Council. That was a good educational lesson for me. Thank you. Mr. Horowitz?
I want to go back to the point that Justice Sykes made, because I think she put it very succinctly, that you can't fix it if it's frozen. That's the problem with the constitutional aspect of the statute. And that's true whether you have to fix it because the assessment was incorrect in the past or because the assessment is non-uniform as a result of changing values in agricultural land, which occur in the future, changes which this court in Norquist said were certain to occur. Now, why should this court decide this case in our favor now when it didn't do it 5 years ago? 5 years ago, you said that this case was premature, and it was premature because we didn't have an owner of agricultural land who had proved what we're now calling the first element of the test, over-assessment, under-assessment, however you interpret that. The problem was not a lack of proof on the second element of the test, because in that element, the statute on its face produces non-uniformity, is certain to produce non-uniformity, as you found in Norquist, and it produces a non-uniformity which is easy to fix. It's practical to eliminate that non-uniformity. We're not talking about the question of as far as practicable when it, in the sense of referring to the fact that there are hundreds of assessors in Wisconsin and you can't make them all robots who are programmed, or clones who are programmed to use the same approach to valuing land. But that's not the as far as practicable problem that's here. What's here is a statute which creates non-uniformity, whether it locks it in or starts it out, but it means that the assessor's hands are tied. And that means that we have non-uniformity, and it was easy to untie the assessor's hands by not having a freeze, if a transition period were needed, having some other formula. There's no problem in saying that you had a formula that was part fair market value and part agricultural use value, because agricultural use value doesn't require the assessor to go out and assess the agricultural land. All he has to do is look at it, figure out how much is grade 1, grade 2, grade 3 in pasture, and there's a table prepared by the Wisconsin Department of Revenue each year. It's in Chapter 11 of the Property Assessment Manual. And it tells the assessor exactly, to the dollar and penny, how much that agricultural land should be assessed. So the transition mechanism was easy to achieve if a transition mechanism at all were necessary.
What if the statute had adopted a transition phase-in formula that was premised on a freeze of 1995 fair market values instead of assessments? Would that have been okay?
No, but it would have been better, because it would then have been based on equalized values and would have eliminated the problem caused by the variation in assessment ratios between municipalities. It would have been better, but it would still have resulted in unconstitutional non-uniformity. And that's a second reason, if you need a second reason, why this statute is unconstitutional. Because that's one of the things it could have done to eliminate some of the non-uniformity that the statute creates. But the basic problem is that a freeze means you can't fix it. You can't fix it if it's already there, and you can't fix it if it arises after the statute was enacted.
Can it be fixed under in the future?
No. It can't be fixed. The only way you can fix it for the future is by declaring this statute unconstitutional and giving the legislature an opportunity. If it still wants use value assessment, the legislature can enact a statute which either puts in use value assessment immediately or puts it in with a transition mechanism that is unconstitutional. And we're asking for relief that begins January 1, 2003. If this court decides the case before then, the legislature has an opportunity to enact a statute which has a constitutional mechanism for use value assessment. Whether it still wants to or not, having seen the effects of use value assessment, is another question.
When is the next legislative session?
When is the legislative session? It's whenever it's called by the governor.
But there isn't one scheduled between now and January 1, 2003.
But there can always be a special session called, and this is certainly the kind of major problem which, if this court declared the statute unconstitutional, it's highly likely that a special session would be called to deal with that problem because of the major impact that this statute has on taxation of land.
In the middle of an election year.
Council, what happens to all the people who have paid the lower taxes as a result of this statute?
They get to keep the benefit because we're not trying to disrupt what has already happened in the past. We want to declare the statute unconstitutional prospectively and not create havoc.
Council, that sounds good, but can that be legitimately done? I mean, if it's unconstitutional ab initio, from the beginning. It doesn't all of a sudden become unconstitutional on a date that you pick.
Well, you did it in Gottlieb.
Oh, okay.
I guess you can do it again.
You can do it as a special case. That was a special case. Maybe that could be distinguished. But, I mean, what about my question? I mean, something doesn't be constitutional beforehand and all of a sudden become unconstitutional.
That's true in theory, but as you decided in Gottlieb, where you declared the statute unconstitutional prospectively, actually it was, you know, 10 days retrospectively, you decided it January 10th and you made it effective January 1, but you can do that recognizing the practicalities that you don't want to, you know, this court wants to uphold the uniformity clause of the Constitution, but it doesn't want to create havoc. I'm not asking it to. I'm asking it to uphold the uniformity clause.
And that was a tax-free provision, too, in Gottlieb.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear
that. That was a tax-free provision in Gottlieb.
Exactly,
also.
And that is the closest case to the one here now. And no quantitative evidence was required in that case to show that the statute was unconstitutional.
Thank you, Mr. Horwitz. Thank you, Mr. Peterson and Mr. Anderson, for excellent arguments in a very difficult